It's great to be back at the campus, really, and to bring you the message of Easter, these three talks on the madness of Easter. Yesterday I spoke on 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 13 and 14, which are printed down there on the left-hand side of your outline and the slip there. And today I'm going to be looking at verse 15. Tomorrow I'll be looking at verses 16 and following. Now, because the crowds change from day to day, there's a little bit of repetition and overlap. For those of you who are there came yesterday, this is just repetition to improve your learning, and therefore bear with me. And those who weren't here yesterday, it's all right, we'll pick you up, you're smart people, that you'll be able to catch up with what's been said already so far. You see on the outline that there's also a tear-off slip, which we're all going to do together in the last few minutes while we're here, because especially with only one door in a lecture theatre, it must be a crush here around about the hour time. So what we need to do is to write on that beforehand, because you won't have time at the last minute to be writing. And you'll see there on the slip that it all tears off, the tribute, yeah, it's going to do it beautifully. And you'll see there three little circles. I'm new and visiting. If you're first time with Campus Bible Study and the Bible Talks, then please tell us that and we'll be in contact with you. Secondly, I'd like to do a course to learn more about Jesus, which is a terrifically important thing. As you can hear, some have become Christians on the basis of almost no knowledge, me. Others become Christians on the basis of a couple of years of searching, David. Be like David. Don't be like me. Search it out. Find out what the truth is. And thirdly, though, I prayed the prayer, because next to it you'll see there is a prayer that I'm going to finish with. Because I'm going to invite you to become Christians today, because some of you may well be ready. You've done your investigation, you've done your thinking about it, and it's time for you to take action, and that's the action we're going to take. Well, let's get underway, shall we? Verse 15 there, it says, "And he died," see the number 15, I call them verses because I'm old-fashioned, "and he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for their sake and was raised." Now, it was on the 19th of September in 1777 when Dr. Jim Johnson observed, "When a man knows that he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. As long as we have food, warmth, shelter, pleasure, sleep, we continue in the idly busy world without much reflection on our purpose. It's in the sad hours, it's in the middle of the night hours, the sleepless hours, when you're awake or sick, worried about the exam or worried about your friends, or the hour of forced sitting beside a dying friend or a crying baby, the hours of worry because your business is going badly or you're feeling wretchedly let down in a romance or by an old friend or by a member of the family or by your parents' divorce. It's in the hours of waiting for the train that never seems to come or waiting for the hangman that the hedonism of atheism, eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow we die, sounds as hollow and superficial as it really is. It's only then that we start to concentrate the mind on what are we doing and why are we doing it. What are we studying for? Why did we choose this faculty? Why did we choose this university? Why did we choose to go to university? Or, to be more accurate, why did our parents choose that we would go to university? Why do we fight so hard to stay alive and to avoid dying? That depressive question. Now, holidays like Easter give us a chance to step back from the busy, busy hustle of a student life to reflect, to think. What's it all about? What's my life about? What am I or who am I living for? Now, of course, the hedonist doesn't. He says, "Oh, it's a holiday. Great. Let's see how much drink I can drink in the course of these 4 days. Let's see how lotto I can get. Let's see how..." And doesn't actually address the reasons for existence. Jesus, he knew why he was living. He was living for his death. It was no surprise to him. He had known about it for years. He had consistently foretold and prophesied its coming. and he resolutely set his face towards Jerusalem as he marched to the city that he knew was going to murder him. But the text on our outline tells us more than that he died. It also tells us why he died. For he didn't die of so-called natural causes. He didn't die by accident. He intentionally laid down his life for a reason and for a purpose. He died as our representative. He died for all. So it speaks of the love of Christ in verse 14, because we have concluded that one has died for all, and therefore all have died. And he died for all. He wasn't dying for himself, but for others. He was intentionally laying down his life for others. Not for some, but for all. And he was brutally killed, not only for his friends, but also and especially for his enemies. He was executed by crucifixion for us. For he died as our representative on our behalf, but more than that, as our substitute. He died in our place. See, the football team, New South Wales, Australia team, they play as our representatives. But sometimes in a game, the coach sends in a substitute, someone who will take the place of somebody else. Jesus dies as our representative. He also dies as our substitute, in our place, on our behalf. We, the guilty, deserve to die. He, the innocent, didn't deserve to die, but he died in our place so that we wouldn't have to face the wrath of God, so that we may be declared right and righteous with the judge of all the earth. That's why he died, and how he represented us in his death. But notice that the purpose for his death in the next sentence of the verse, that those who live may no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. Notice his death for us was not that we be forgiven in order that we go on living the way we used to live, but that he died for us that we may be changed, that we may live a different kind of life than the life that we've lived, a new life, a transformed life, a purposeful and intentional life. For our lives after his death are to be different. We're no longer, he says, no longer to live the way that we have always lived, the natural way to live, that everybody lives, the sane and sensible, rational way of life that our society teaches us. For from our earliest days we live this way. It's second nature to us to live this way. Nobody needs to teach it to us. In fact, in a very contradictory fashion, our parents and teachers all try to teach us the exact opposite. But they fail. We keep doing what is natural to us. We all do. We keep on going on in exactly the way that we were raised to do it, really. It's so natural for us all. I knew it before I met you. And you could know it of me before you met me. It's just the way we operate. In fact, our business codes, our legal structures, all assume that everybody is operating this way. It's called living for yourself. It is the way the world operates. If everybody was living for others, you couldn't do a law degree at New South Wales University, because we wouldn't need lawyers. Now, that would be an interesting world, wouldn't it? No lawyers. We'd still need engineers. And men, nomadic ladies, still need engineers. But lawyers, we could do without them. In fact, a lot of the commerce faculty would disappear too, wouldn't it? Especially those tax consultants. You wouldn't need them, because everybody living for others would want to pay tax. Now, that'd be a weird world, wouldn't it? That would actually change political science, would you? See, if actually people were living like that, a whole range of the ways that our society operates would just dissipate and disappear. But nobody's living that. That's not how we live. That's not the natural way. And now that Jesus has died for us, we're to no longer live that way. We're now to live no longer for ourselves. And you have to teach children to be selfish. There's nothing much more selfish than a little child. You'll constantly teach your children, now make sure you share your toys. Make sure you wait for others before you start eating. In fact, pass the cakes around. Now, you don't take the last cake yourself. Offer it to your friend. To which the child says, but he might eat it. Can't you hear the thousands and thousands of lessons that your mother and your father drip, drip, drip away on your head about being unselfish? But yet, your parents failed, didn't they? As every parent fails. As their parents failed them too. It's like telling lies. You never have to teach your children to tell lies. Never have to. It's just second nature for us to tell lies. One of my children, the very first sentence that she uttered was a lie. Until then she'd said words, but she finally strung the words together into a grammatical sentence. As she stood there with the television antenna broken in her hands, and we came in like stupid parents do and said to her, what have you done? And she stood there and said, Matthew did it. He had been at school for several hours at that stage. That was her first sentence. We keep reminding her, Matthew did it. We didn't teach her to tell lies. She just knew to tell lies. Now, take lying. It's a simple illustration of morality, isn't it? Hands up those amongst us here who believe that telling lies is a good thing. Now, just to make sure you're understanding and you're still alive with me, hands up those who believe telling lies is a bad thing. Yeah, they have hands, okay. Hands up those of you who have never told a lie. You can tell one now, if you like. Okay, so we've got a room full of liars, is that correct? Oh, I knew that before I came in, you see. Because the Bible tells me that we live for ourselves, and lying is just an expression of that. I used that illustration some years ago at Southampton, and afterwards a very uppity Englishman came to the door of the meeting where I was at, and he said to me with considerable vigour, especially for an Englishman, he said, it is true that I tell lies, but I want you to know I'm not a liar. Stormed off. That is a very interesting philosophical question, isn't it? As to what is a liar if it's not someone who tells lies. But see, we don't like thinking of ourselves as liars, do we? You don't introduce yourself as, you know, I'm Philip Jensen, I'm a liar. An alcoholic will say, I'm Philip Jensen, I'm an alcoholic. At least in an AA meeting. But there are no Liars Anonymous meetings. Because you don't have to have a Liars Anonymous meeting because all people there are liars and everybody is. So there's no anonymity in being a liar. But we keep it as anonymous as we can. Lies are just another form of living for ourselves, and they're universal. And just as we hate people telling us lies, we hate people being selfish. And we just don't hate it now that people, in those wakeful hours in the middle of the night, when we're thinking straight, we hate it in ourselves most of all. Don't like thinking of myself as being selfish. Or as being a liar. We even know that it's not the best way to live. We know that telling lies creates havoc in our relationships. We know that being selfish is counterproductive, both at home and at work, anywhere. It's only as we think and act for the benefit of other people that we get on harmoniously with others and with ourselves. But yet we're all selfish. Some atheists, notably Ayn Rand, whom I mentioned yesterday, have tried to create an ethical system out of selfishness. Ethical egoism, as it was called. But nobody in their right mind wants an Ayn Rand disciple as a friend. We had one as a prime minister once. Malcolm Fraser was a very keen follower of Ayn Rand, running the country on ethical egoism. But you wouldn't want to have a friend who's an ethical egoist because they use you. And when you're no longer useful to them, they dispense with you. Now, there's an ideal way of having a friend, I don't think. But that is a logical outcome, rational outcome, of atheism. Now, some people have a problem with appropriate assertiveness in communication and need to be taught about how to appropriately express their needs and wishes, but that's a psychological problem. They still have a problem with selfishness. They just need help. But if everybody is against selfishness, and yet everybody does it, how can we hope to see the world get better? How can we hope to see people changed? That they, well, forget about them for a moment, that we would no longer live for ourselves. What needs to change? And part of the answer is to have a positive alternative, that we no longer live for ourselves but for Him. You see, previously we couldn't see anything in our life bigger or more important than ourselves. Sure, there were those occasions when we might put somebody first, but in general in our life, there was nobody else more important than ourselves. I got a phone call once when I was here at the university by a student who wanted to come and see me, have an appointment with me, in order to punch my lights out, to quote his phrase. And it's always nice to have that kind of appointment. Oh, yeah, sure, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll be just ready for you. And I said, why? And he said, well, his girlfriend had become a Christian, and as a result of becoming a Christian, had dropped him. And so he was really angry because it was all my fault, you see, because the girl had become a Christian, and so therefore it was my fault that she dropped him. When he arrived, and I confess, but tentative on this issue. I didn't know how big he was. He was in the building faculty, and some of them are bigger than average, but he was a mental builder, not a physical one. Unfortunately, he's a little fella. Made him feel considerably better. When he arrived into my office, I said to him, well, how are you? He said, I've worked it out. I want to become a Christian. I said, no, you can't get your girl back that way. He said, no, I don't want to do that. And I said, well, why do you want to become a Christian? He said, the Swift Bridge was up. And so I had to sit there in the bus fuming for a while. And as I was sitting there fuming, I thought, why am I so angry? And he said, I realised that she had something in her life more important than me. And I have nothing in my life more important than me. So I want to know about what can be more important than me. He became a Christian. You want to know the next question, don't you? All romantics in this room now want to know the rest of the story. On the grounds that some of you are now not going to listen, and I tell you, they never got back together again. Which was really good because it showed he had become a Christian. It wasn't just a thing to get back to her. He'd finally tumbled to the fact that, but she was let off a terrible fortunate thing, wasn't she? Because she'd been going out with a man for whom there was nothing more important in the world than himself. Can I suggest to you girls, that's a lousy husband. You'll have a rotten marriage with a man who thinks there's no one in life more important than himself. That's a real pain of a man to marry. However, let's get back to her point here. You see, sometimes when we're on our best behaviour, we can think of other people first. Like when we first fall in love, and we can't do enough for that special person. Or when we have a first child and we spend hours just looking at him or her, wondering how wonderful the little baby is. But putting aside those moments of right thinking and their right behaviour, our lives are dominated by ourselves. So when the girlfriend, boyfriend doesn't turn out to be all that you thought they were at first, when they won't do the things you want to do and to make their life a sacrifice for you, or when the baby is just filled with a routine of eating and vomiting and changing those endless dirty nappies, and you discover that the best time for the baby is when it's asleep and can't say anything or do anything, and you get back to your own life to do your own thing, self-centeredness enters in once more. However, when we meet Jesus, we meet somebody who is genuinely bigger and greater and more magnificent than anything or anyone we've ever imagined. We've met somebody who is actually greater, better than ourselves. And then we have someone to live for who will never let us down, who loves us unconditionally, having already died for us. He's always with us. He's always on our side. He's always seeking our welfare as we seek his. Who makes a difference to the lives of people, a difference that changes society and cultures and individuals. For we Christians don't live for a dead man. We don't give ourselves from memory. We don't spend our time visiting a family vault remembering somebody who died a long, long time ago. We don't spend our lives keeping alive the memories of our ancestors and burning little joss sticks to them or leaving fruit before them. We are living for the living, not living for the dead. Easter is the time when we remember that he died for our sake, but also that he rose to new life and gives us eternity. And that's why we divide the calendar BC and AD. See, BC before Christ, that's easy enough, isn't it? But most people say, well, why don't you have AC, after Christ? You can't have after Christ, because Christ is risen from the dead. There is no after. He is always there. He is alive now, ruling now. There never comes to an end when you can say, okay, this is after Christ. You can say it's after Caesar. You can say it's after Napoleon. You can say it's after Churchill. But you can never say it's after Christ, because he is risen from the dead. The atheists understand this, because they are so keen to get away from AD, which is the Latin Anno Domini, in the year of the Lord, that they come up with this politically correct nonsense called Common Era. And they insist in their political arrogance that you write BCE and CE. But of course, it's a complete stupidity of political correctness, because there never has been a Common Era. The Jews date the world from Moses. The Muslims date the world from Muhammad. There's no Common Era for all humanity. The only Common Era is within the Christianized world, which dates everything from Jesus. That's the only Common Era. And even when they do date it as BCE and CE, the year they pick is the time of the birth of Jesus. So, what's this Common Era? It's the Christian era that we're talking of. And we worship the one who is alive now. That's why we say Anno Domini. See, we have confidence in the evidence of his resurrection, for repeatedly in the New Testament we see evidences of his resurrection. That's why we read Luke chapter 24 a few moments ago, as David read it for us, where it recounts one of the occasions when the disciples saw him. They didn't just see him, they touched him. They didn't just see him and touch him, they watched him eat a meal. That's what they had. See, he wasn't a ghost. They had to wash the dishes up after he finished. They weren't superstitious, gullible idiots who knew no better. They were astonished at his appearance. So would I be. Dead man walks in a room, I'd be astonished. And you'll notice in verse 41 there it says, they still disbelieved. Even though they'd seen him, they were still disbelieving. With joy. Of course you'd be disbelieving face to face with a man that you saw publicly executed 3 days beforehand, now standing in a room, now sitting down, now actually eating fish in front of you. Yeah, it was overwhelming, the experience they went through. Pincus Lapide, I forgot to bring a book with me to wave to you, but it exists. Pincus Lapide, L-A-P-I-D-E. I spell it for you so that you'll look it up and check it out in your own library. Pincus, lovely name, isn't it, Pincus? Pincus Lapide, L-A-P-I-D-E, was a Jewish scholar and diplomat, a historian of the late 20th century, interested in first century Judaism, and so, therefore, Christianity. He investigated the historical evidence as to Jesus' resurrection. At first, he couldn't believe what he found, for he wouldn't accept that Jesus could have risen from the dead. But when he changed his prejudice and accepted the possibility of a resurrection, he was overwhelmed by the historical evidences. And so he wrote a book called The Resurrection of Jesus. Boring title, but it is what it is. The subtitle is A Jewish Perspective, published by Abingdon Press, 1983. He wrote, I accept the resurrection of Jesus not as an invention of the community of disciples, but as an historical event. What's so remarkable about this book, and why I mention this one to you, because there's any number, there's hundreds of books on the resurrection of Jesus. Why I mention this one is because he remained Jewish to his death in 1997, while accepting the facts of the resurrection as a historian. Because when you look at the evidences with an open mind, that is one that allows the possibility of a resurrection for the dead, then the evidence is overwhelming. However, more importantly, look at together our text.
where it says, "And he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised." Jesus is the one we are to live for, because he is the one who died for us, for our sakes. We didn't deserve his life and kindness. We didn't deserve his sacrifice for us. We deserve the death of selfish people who keep telling God to get lost out of their lives. We keep turning our back on God. Very rude to turn your back on people, isn't it? It's one of the ways to rebel against people. Actually, just turn around and have nothing to do with them. This is something it's my better side, isn't it, really? But there's something fundamentally rude with the person who turns his back on you. But don't we do that with God? Well, we spend more time watching the television, searching the net. We spend more time in the shower than we actually ever do thinking about God, talking to God, listening to God, reading his word. We push God to the margins of our life, not the centre of our life, and certainly not anywhere where he's going to call upon me to change what I'm doing. You see, that girl became a Christian. When she became a Christian, she realised that her relationship with this bloke was completely wrong. So she broke off her relationship, because she was no longer living for herself, she was now living for Jesus. That's a change. That's a huge change in most people's lifetime. We don't have God at the centre. We don't have God anywhere where he's going to tell us what to do. We don't have God as God. We're therefore the ones who deserve the verdict of being deserted by God. To die cut off from the source of life as Jesus did. He died though for our sake that we might give up selfish living and live for him, who not only died for our sake but also was raised to life again. For see how the text finished? And was raised. The person we're to live for is alive and well, sitting on the throne of heaven, ruling the universe. We don't worship a dead man, but a living Lord. Buddha is dead. Muhammad is dead. Joseph Smith is dead. Karl Marx is dead. Sigmund Freud is dead. Don Bradman is dead. I don't know who you're going to live for, but they're dead. Jesus Christ is alive. That is a huge difference. For he so bore our punishment fully that death could not hold him. So we're to live for him with whom we can communicate, we can talk, we can pray. He continues to care for us and look after us and watch over us. Some people, like Muslims, claim Jesus didn't die. Others, like atheists, claim that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. They can't be all right, can they? Somebody must be wrong. It could be Christians are wrong. Maybe he didn't rise from the dead. Maybe he didn't die. Maybe he never lived. But the evidence that shows he lived is the same evidence that showed that he died. And the evidence that shows that he died is the same evidence that shows that he rose from the dead. So who do you think Jesus is? Do you believe he lived? On what basis do you believe that? Do you believe he died? Well, how do you know that? Do you believe he rose from the dead? Well, on what basis do you know that? That's why you see this little course is so important that we're offering, because there are people who don't know. That's all right. Find out. Because if this is true, this is the meaning of life. This is the meaning of your life. So find out. Tick the little circle up there. I'd like to do the course and find out more about Jesus. The man who wrote this text for us, 2 Corinthians text for us, Paul the Apostle, he was no believer in the resurrection of Jesus. The death of Jesus showed him that Jesus had actually been an imposter. And so he went about persecuting this imposter's followers. He was the first great persecutor of Christians. But then one day, on the road to Damascus, he met the risen Lord Jesus. And after that, he met with others who had been there in the upper room, watching Jesus eat the fish. And he got first-hand information about Jesus' life and his death and his resurrection. And he came He came to understand that Jesus' death was not a failure, but God's great success in dealing with our rebellion, in dealing with his wrath against us, in dealing with our death. He came to see that Jesus' resurrection changed not only the world and eternity, he came to see that the resurrection changed his own self and life. For now he could no longer live for himself, but for others. And so he joined that campaign that we read about in Luke 24, verses 46, where Jesus said to them, "It's written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem." And that man, from that day on, spent the rest of his life, a hard life, a difficult life, a life the world would call mad, spent his life telling people about Jesus. And as a result of that, the whole of European history was changed. He was the first man to preach in Europe. Europe became Christian by that man and his teaching. And we, on the other end of the world, in a country that didn't exist as far as he was concerned, we are talking about it today and reading what he wrote. The change in a life is the change that I've seen in students on this campus over 30 years as people come to know Jesus as the one who died for them and rose again, and so no longer live for themselves but for him. For whom do we live? By nature, it's for ourselves. We've rejected our Creator and our Maker, and we choose to live my life, my way. Even though we don't like selfishness, we love Frank Sinatra's old song, "And I Did It My Way." In some measure, we learn how to be unselfish, at least in public, stand up in a bus for someone who's old and crippled, and really they have to be terribly old and crippled to get a seat these days, but they can. But even though we know selfishness is bad, even though we don't like ourselves when we're selfish, yet we don't seem to be able to do anything about it, because just getting taught lessons, "Share your toys," it doesn't work. It's a deep-seated heart problem for your whole life. You have to have something in your life bigger than you to be unselfish. And if you don't know yet, know Jesus, if you don't know him who died for you, if you don't know him who rose from the dead for you, if you don't know what his death means for you or the forgiveness of sins means for you, if you don't understand this yet, I'm glad you're with us. Keep coming to the Bible Talks week by week here. But fill out the tick the box, find out more. Because this is the way out of that terrible prison called self-centeredness. But if you do know him who died for you and was raised for you, then stop living for yourself and start living for him. How? Well, that's what the prayer is. Look at the prayer. It's got three paragraphs. The first paragraph is the acknowledgement of self-centeredness. "I know I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you, ignoring you. I need forgiveness." The second paragraph thanks God for what he has done for self-centered people like you and me. "Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. I need forgiveness. Jesus dies for my forgiveness. And thank you that he rose from the dead to give me a new life, a different way of living." And so the prayer of the prayer is the last paragraph. "Please forgive me. I need forgiveness. Jesus dies for my forgiveness. Please forgive me. Secondly, please change me. No point being forgiven to go on living the same old way. Please change me. But the change that is involved is that I may live with Jesus as my ruler. No longer for myself, but for him who died for me and rose again." I'm going to pray that prayer now, friends, just to show you in a sense how simple and easy it is to become a Christian. You can do it without the information, like I did. You can do it with the information, like David did. If you're saying, "I'm not ready to pray that prayer," and you're honest, it's because you're going to tick that box about finding out more. If you're saying, I'm not ready to pray that prayer, I don't know enough, but I'm not going to tick the box, I'm suggesting to you that you're not even being honest with yourself. You're just demonstrating once more, you don't want God in your life. You want to be sovereign of yourself. You are self-centered, fundamentally. So never be surprised when you show yourself to be selfish. But are you ready that you would actually give your life to Him? Well, if so, join with me as I pray. I'll pray out loud. You're just in the quietness of your own heart to God. Dear God, I know that I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I am guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your Son to die for me, that I may be forgiven. Thank you that He rose from the dead to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me, that I may live with Jesus as my ruler.